segue to what I'm going to talk about, which is a very specific subsector of media workers, and that's freelance journalists. So thank you all for coming. So as you've already heard, my book looks at the politics of freelance media work, so the labor politics of this work, particularly freelance journalism, and I look particularly at writers from a historical perspective up into the new and expanding digital media industries. And then the second half of the book, what I'm going to talk about today is collective organizing, the opportunities and challenges of organizing this constituency. And the larger context, which I think Kat outlined really well, is we have this media industry in flux right now. Obviously, there's a lot of technological change. The word crisis is thrown around a lot, but we're still dealing with, as Tanner outlined, some really powerful and very profitable media companies, even the legacy, so-called legacy media companies, as well as an expanding digital media sector. So the growth of digital-first media outlets that are opening Canadian offices is rapid, and lots of people are very excited about this because it potentially means jobs for journalists. But we have this sort of double movement with an expanding potential workforce, but the contracting of full-time, unionized, well-paid, secure jobs that, as Kat pointed out, you can sort of build a career on, and a growth in precarious work, including internships, unpaid internships, freelance work, contract work, part-time work, etc. And also, freelancing is not a new form of work, obviously, particularly in media and cultural industries, which has historically been based on independent contractors of some sort. But it's becoming a lot more prominent as companies lay off workers. So full-time journalists are now losing their jobs and starting to work freelance. So there's the push into freelance employment. As technologies enable people to work from anywhere, which is a push and a pull factor, and as more and more people enter into media work and pursuing either their passion or their commitment to some sort of democratic form of communications and running into a situation where there's no jobs. So the phrase, I think I cited Leah Vosko in my work, but it applies that there's a lot of work, but there's no jobs. So there's a ton of opportunities to write, but it's getting harder and harder to make a living, let alone earn any money doing that kind of work. So we see this contradiction in media where we have the most amount of content that we've ever had circulating through many different platforms, but it's become very, very difficult to earn a living explicitly just producing journalism. So we see a lot of journalists, I'll talk about their coping strategies in a minute. So what I want to talk about is the what to do part of organizing in the sector, but I'm just going to outline the challenges. So the first half of the book very, very briefly. And this is based on a survey I did with about 200 self-identified freelance writers, so people who are doing journalism but increasingly having to do corporate work and non-journalistic forms of work, as well as interviews with organizers and members of freelance writers groups, and literature reviews, etc. So, Kat did a great job of outlining many of the challenges, but some specific things that apply to freelancers are low pay, so the rates that you can earn selling your work to magazines and newspapers and digital outlets, which are new, but these rates have been the same since the 1970s, so freelance journalists' incomes are quite low. So half of my survey respondents earn about $20,000 from freelance writing, even though 71% say it's their main job. So the pay freelancers earn doesn't really reflect their skill levels, their education levels, and their experience, particularly because so many are coming from full-time jobs in newspapers or other, or broadcasting, for example. Pay is very arbitrary, so freelancers get paid per word or per piece, and there's really no reason that rates are set the way they are, and rates that you can get paid differ depend on who you know, your gender, your geography, how well you can negotiate, if you can ask for more money. And especially online, rates of pay are extremely low. So we're talking like 10 to 20 cents a word for articles. So there's a reason why these are called content factories, because they're producing so much material and it's very, very cheap to produce because they're not paying very much money to produce it. There's a lot of unpaid work. So not just writing for free or for exposure, in the hopes of building a portfolio to land work, but just all the non-paid tasks that are required to produce a piece of writing that the per word model doesn't account for. So researching, pitching, interviewing, editing, invoicing, chasing publishers who don't pay, marketing yourself, building your website, etc. There's a huge problem with highly restrictive and exploitative contracts for copyright, where companies are taking all the rights to works for very little pay. There's obvious challenges that come with employment status as a freelancer or an independent contractor. So a lack of access to labor and social protections, no guarantee of work, you can be fired just by not being able to, your editor just stops phoning you and you have no more work. There's a big challenge that freelancers face with sort of forced entrepreneurialism, where you really have to survive, let alone thrive in this work, become an entrepreneur. So you have to market and brand yourself. There's constant hustle to find contacts and your next assignment. Freelancers really complain of this perpetual need to constantly be looking for work. So every person you meet is a potential source of work. Freelancers work varied and unpredictable hours. They work very long hours, which sort of undermines the reason they become freelancers in the first place, which is to have control over their time. Or as many say, we have the ability to go for a run in the middle of the afternoon. Very few people are doing that. And there's also a lack of control, which also one of the main reasons people say they go freelance is to have control over their work. But freelancers can't control when there will be work, how much work there is to do, and they have to perpetually be available. So many speak of the sort of feast or famine nature of freelance work. And finally, and this is reflected in the challenge for organizing, is this sort of a structural individualism that you have to participate in to be a freelancer. The mode of work doesn't really encourage any sort of solidarity with others or any ability to connect with others or some sort of collective response. So I find, as most people researching in this field find, that there's deepening power imbalance between the very large, powerful corporations that are contracting individual workers and the individual workers on whom all of this responsibility for funding and producing journalism is now falling. And this is bad for journalism, so it limits the kind of media content that we can have. And we do reports show a lack of, a sort of decline in investigative journalism, critical work, and most freelance journalists are abandoning journalism and producing corporate writing instead. So there's a sort of scary brain drain happening in Canadian journalism. And it also limits who can participate, so who can afford to fight their way into media industries by becoming a freelancer and taking on all of this unpaid work. And particularly, people from historically marginalized groups are having a hard time, as I said, fighting their way in by becoming freelancers. So we have a lack of diverse perspectives and opinions, and we see this reflected in Canadian media. So what have freelancers been doing? So, you know, up until very recently, most people have been coping. They've been working more to make more money. They've been borrowing money, relying on family and friends, taking on entrepreneurial tactics like promotion and advertising, or quitting journalism and taking on other forms of work. There has been some resistant activity, and I think, you know, we can't obviously attribute this to social media, but the ability for freelancers who are sort of isolated and work alone to talk to each other has really helped some of these initiatives. So we've seen more and more first-person accounts of exploitative practices and conditions. So this was a big piece that was published in the New York Times. People are obviously posting on their blogs and Tumblrs. There's been anonymous collective expressions of dissent through tweets, hashtags, parody accounts such as crap writing gigs on Twitter, which, you know, do serve as a useful outlet for individual freelancers. We also see campaigns and projects like Who Pays Writers, which is a sort of crowdsourced collection of who pays what and how long it takes to get paid. So you can see how low these rates of pay are at some of these prestigious publications. But it sort of makes such an opaque process of paying freelancers transparent. So these have been quite useful projects that freelancers have engaged in. We've also seen campaigns in Canada. There's been a successful campaign. This one was unsuccessful, but it was revived against TC Media, which is a magazine conglomerate, and a terrible contract that they had for writers, which unions and writers groups led and were able to change. So there has been some activity, but we have seen, and that's what I wanted to talk about, is a greater call for actual organization and unionization. And this quote is just one of many I've seen from freelance writers saying that, you know, the only real difference between arts workers and creative workers and other workers is that we're just not organized, and we haven't thought of ourselves as people who can form unions, but it is time to do so. So, you know, there have actually been many opportunities and experiments in organizing that writers in particular have formed over the years. So I'm not going to talk about these, but the US has the National Writers Union, and there's the National Union of Journalists in the UK, and in Canada, and the Quebec Freelancers Union is quite active. And in Canada, we've got dozens of professional associations for any stripe of writer that you may be. So, you know, freelancers are often painted as sort of lone wolves or mavericks, but they are actually joiners. But going to the step of being able to, for example, collectively negotiate for a contract or build any sort of collective pressure to improve pay and change contracts has been a real challenge and is an ongoing challenge. And I'll just briefly mention some of the challenges that I'm sure you can imagine. So it's really hard to organize freelancers. It's very hard to find them. Freelancers are contracted under highly individual terms, so most don't know what others are paid, what they could be paid, what it would be okay to ask for. It's a very fluid occupation, so people drift in and out of freelance status between jobs while working full-time. Many people write and sell articles who have no interest in being a journalist for a living. So it's very hard to find people, to count numbers of people, to get an accurate statistic of how many people are working as freelance journalists at all. Freelancers work in physical isolation, so again, they're hard to find and organize. And they all have different mindsets about how to address some of the challenges they face, or different diagnoses of what the problems are. The relations of production make it really difficult to sort of name and address power relations. So many freelancers feel that they work with their editors, who are their friends, and they have no contact with the people actually setting the terms of their employment, which are generally the publishers and their giant legal departments. There's also the individual's name is on the article and also on the invoice that you send to your media company after your work is published. So freelancers really feel that they are working for themselves rather than working for somebody else. And for unions, historically, this has been a somewhat small constituency that has not really been worth trying to organize. As well, the collective agreements of media unions often have worked to limit the amount of work that gets contracted out. So freelancers haven't really been of interest to unions, and freelancers have felt that unions work against their interests. The biggest challenge, of course, is the legal challenge. So under labor law, freelancers are independent contractors. They can't participate in collective bargaining. And this is despite the fact that many freelancers are misclassified and they are actually dependent on one organization. Many are fired from their jobs and rehired under a freelance contract. But, you know, they are legally positioned as independent contractors. They're also understood to be entrepreneurs and small business owners, so they're outside the scope of labor law, which doesn't really support the unionization of workers who move between work sites. Of course, there are some exceptions in the cultural sector, so ACTRA, Musicians Union, and construction workers, but these are based on voluntary recognition, so companies can't be forced to negotiate. As well, collectively organizing to try and increase rates of pay would also put freelancers at risk of violating Canada's Competition Act, which would see them as coming together to set prices and potentially be charged with conspiracy in restraint of trade. I mean, this seems absurd when you consider the power relations of writers and publishers, but this is also a challenge. Another major challenge is occupational ideology. And this is really interesting to think about in contrast to what Kat talked about with how digital news digital media workers have been quite willing to join unions. You know, freelancers, I still see, I still see the idea of objectivity used as a way to justify not wanting to join unions, so that journalists say, you know, they can be influenced by interest groups, which is very interesting why young journalists don't see that. But there's the occupational ideology is really one of entrepreneurs, professionals, artists, and I argue in the book that this is really being been reinforced by the long history of of professional association as the preferred model of organizing freelancers. So, in my last minute, which I totally misjudged the time, I have lots of quotes about why freelancers wouldn't join a union that reflect some of the challenges I outlined. But you know, there is some desire for some sort of representation. So surveys, mine wasn't as overwhelmingly yes, but more recent surveys have found that freelancers would join unions for certain issues. So it's an interesting time, and there's lots of experiments underway in Canada right now. I think sort of an unprecedented level of organizing. So I'm just going to blast through these examples, and I'm happy to talk more about them. But we've gone from having the biggest and longest standing professional association that has really represented writers as individuals and focused on career development, has really been unable to push for any meaningful change. They've done advocacy, they've been engaged in a class action lawsuit that has had some interesting effects, but you know, professional associations have tended to reinforce the neoliberal idea of the self-sufficient individual, and has not wanted to engage in any sort of antagonistic relationship with publishers in the magazine industry. And so I have this quote from one of the executive directors who was charged with turning the organization from a grassroots membership-driven organization that in the 1970s was actually able to negotiate contracts and twice threatened to go on strike into a very sort of entrepreneurial-focused professional association. So certain members got a little bit frustrated with that, and in 2009, or around 2007 to 2009, started organizing a union. And so we have this Canadian Freelance Union, which is the first union outside of the CMG, which represents freelancers at the CBC, to represent freelance media workers. And it began as a campaign of the CEP before the CEP merged with Unifor and is now one of Unifor's two community chapters. And when it started, it was a campaign Unifor realized that they needed to do something about freelancers and the sort of job loss in Canadian journalism. And they recruited 600 charter members, which is quite a lot of interest. It was $25 to join, and there was a lot of excitement and hope around this new initiative. The idea was to try and create a closed shop model where media companies would have to use union labor, and also to negotiate freelance clauses into contracts at newsrooms where the union was already negotiating, which they've tried twice and they haven't had any success. So, as time went on and it became an official union, they had to start recruiting actual members, and you know, we see the challenges that you can imagine with the freelance union. As of last year, April, they had about 250 members, and it's only been recently that the CFU has started to engage in actual organizing and campaigning. They've increased their social media presence, they hold social events, but there are challenges, and you know, I'll skip through, but one of the major ones is the understanding that freelancers have of unions. So this person said that when the union actually achieves a binding contract, that's when they'll join. So, you know, there's sort of a lack of an understanding of how unions work and building a union works. Okay, so then came along an agency to represent, the first literary agency to represent freelance journalists, launched by Derek Finkel, a former freelance journalist. And this is a very interesting case because it came up at the same time as the CFU, and Derek Finkel talks about the power imbalance. He sort of uses the terms that union organizers would use, but he is interested in representing only the top-tier writers. It's a for-profit business where he'll negotiate contracts for individual writers. This agency raised some interesting tensions around worker representation, and freelance writers were quite surprised by the fact that this would really help a very small group of writers, where you know, everybody needed some support. So this took a very interesting twist when in 2010 the Canadian Writers Group partnered with the Canadian Media Guild to become a sort of agency union partnership. They invested money in the agency, and anyone who Derek Finkel represented could become a member of the union, and anybody could join the union, but you didn't necessarily get to be part of this literary agency. So it was a really interesting experiment. I think it was the way the Canadian Media Guild sought to get into this freelance constituency. Unsurprisingly, it ended in, they did things like set up Storyboard, which has become a really useful site of discussing labor issues among freelancers. And the partnership broke up amicably because, as I had predicted, Finkel got kind of tired of the labor side of this, tired of fighting with publishers, he realized what a union would actually entail and decided to separate. So the CMG has sort of gone alone and has established a freelance branch and offers the same sort of services that the Canadian Freelancers Union, I'm going to end in a minute, would offer, but is really trying to straddle the line between professional association that offers career development, networking, ways for freelancers to find work with union and labor politics. So they're working on, for example, getting tens of thousands of dollars back from a publishing company in Alberta that has stiffed freelancers. So there's all these interesting experiments underway, and I think that we are at a time where we really need to represent freelance media workers and find out how to get around the sort of legal blocks to doing so. And we have these interesting experiments underway, but just like freelance media work itself, these organizing efforts are kind of riddled with contradictions. And finding the balance between professional association and union is a tricky one. Ultimately, talking to journalists and listening to how they understand their own work and their own their attitudes towards organizing, I think we really need to figure out, these organizing efforts need to figure out a way to address this constituency as workers, and challenge the long-held occupational identity as professionals in particular. Okay, so I'm happy to talk more about these later. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Nicole.